How long have you been in the States?
I've only been about a week, 5 or 6 days.
Where do you stay when you're here?
Well, I've stayed at various places. I stay at the Drake now, and which isn't bad. It's near the publisher and centrally located and not too expensive.
The Drake Hotel.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You're going on a tour.
I'm off tomorrow. Yeah. I'm starting in New York, a couple of days in New York, then I go to San Francisco, Los Angeles.
Because you're a peripatetic traveler in any event, so this shouldn't be too hard on you. Huh?
Yeah, well, it's, a transient profession ours, but traveling as you get older is less pleasant also as the world gets more crowded.
Have you been on a book tour before?
Yes, I have, several times.
What's it like?
Well, the trouble with a book tour is that very often you hear yourself saying the same thing, which is never too nice. It depends to where you go. You know, if the people are well informed, if people have actually read the book, it's a big help. I went on a book tour very recently on an old book because Clint Eastwood made White Hunter Black Heart after 30 years of lying dormant. And I did tour. It wasn't really, actually, the paperback came out and it was published again in Germany and so on. And I did rather an extensive tour with him. And without him, which was enjoyable. It's a book I've written that I like very much and that people are interested in.
Yeah, you say it's been dormant, but, somehow a good book never dies, does it?
Well, you hope for that. Everybody hopes that you're not going to go out of print or that people are still going to read it and be interested. Now, the book doesn't age. It's very funny. Movies age quite a bit, and then some manage, just as some books manage, to somehow not lose the magic.
Yeah, movies can age, but the books and the movies that touch us in ways that don't date themselves, that where they reach the heart.
Yeah, and that's true. It's very true, but there are, for instance, Casablanca is a movie that everybody loves. I never liked it very much at the beginning, and I still think it's very exaggerated, the passion people have for it. But there you are, never quarrel with a hit, they say.
I can't understand that. This has been a year in which a couple of books have come out by Casablanca, which crossed my desk. And I've seen that movie I don't know how many times because it's just something you see.
Sure.
And I'm still trying to figure out why people care about that film as much as they do.
It's incredible. I think Bogey has something to do with it. Ingrid. But the movie was rather cowardly politically, really. It wasn't a great story, but it has something that catches hold of people's imagination. Claude Rains was marvelous in it, I don't know. You can't. It's very difficult to tell. But there are movies like, I could name a few that have endured, that you see them today and you say, God, that's wonderful,
When you consider Casablanca, it was shot on a back lot.
Yeah.
Everything was kind of phony. Everything was staged. I guess the personality of the stars.
I suppose.
Now, I read Dangerous Friends, and the thing that struck me in reading the book is during this period of the 50s, is there anyone that you didn't know?
Well, if you're brought up in that town, as I was, my father was in the business, my father was a director. In the 20s, in the late 20s, he worked with Ruth Chatterton, Dorothy McHale. I mean, people's names that are totally forgotten by now. And my mother worked for Garbo, wrote Garbo scripts for MGM. You grow up in that background, you're bound to almost know everyone, certainly in the movie business.
Your mother had a kind of, I think you referred to it in the book, as a salon.
Well, yes, that's what it became known in retrospect. It was a time when many people were escaping from Europe, from Hitler, from Austria, from Germany, and even from France to a certain extent. And many of them came there, and as she was a very warm-hearted woman, she invited them. And many of them were people who she'd known in Germany and in Europe, and she made friends very easily, and it really developed, I suppose, into a salon. It was Sunday tea parties, mostly.
I have a feeling you're the kind of guy who makes friends very easily, too.
Yeah, I've inherited that, I think, to some extent. I like people.
Dangerous Friends takes place essentially over roughly a 10-year period, doesn't it?
Yeah, the 50s, more or less, yeah. It starts a little earlier than that, but...
And the dominant characters, of course, are indeed John Huston and Ernest Hemingway, but plenty of others are Irwin Shaw, and plenty of other people are interwoven throughout the book. But maybe we ought to start with Hemingway, because the book opens in Ketchum, Idaho, where you first met to Hemingway. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, well, you know, for us, for my generation of writers or newspaper people, or anyone almost, Hemingway was a compelling figure. Not only was he a marvelous writer, he was an innovator, a literary innovator, a new style. He simplified the language. But he was also an adventurer, an adventurous character, in that he fought in Spain. He was a man of very strong opinions. And so to meet him by accident was rather an overwhelming experience for a kid who had just written one novel. And I think that, as I put in the book, as I wrote, I never would have gone up to him and said, listen, my name is Peter and so on. But he was really a very paternal figure and enjoyed being that. So he sought us out. I mean, he saw my wife going in and out of the motel where we lived next door to his cabin. And the surprising thing was that he rather initiated the sort of one-sided friendship. One-sided in that I was a very young man and unknown, and he was already an elderly man, although only in his 50s, and one of the most celebrated authors in the world.
I guess they didn't call him Papa for nothing. Right?
No, yes, and that he liked to be called Papa is rather remarkable. For a man, he was only, what was he, was about 1948, he wasn't even 50. He was 49 years old.
So he kind of took charge of your life and to a degree.
Yes, he...
Or at least your social life, I would say.
There. And he had a great influence. He felt that I should, you know, as the book states, that I shouldn't work in the movies, that he felt that was bad for a writer. And I think he's probably right. If you want to be a novelist, that's not the place to sell your wares, Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right. He advised you against writing screenplays.
Yeah, he said you said goodbye to that town with your first novel. And so go on. But it's, of course...
He could say that.
Well, you know, he had a very... for many years as a very young man, he wrote short stories that were only published in Germany in a magazine called the Querschnitt. And he really wasn't successful. But the first novel created such a tremendous stir that he didn't have big financial problems from that day on. He also, his second wife was a very wealthy woman, which helped. But, you know, to make a living as a writer is a very, very difficult trade.
Yeah, I was talking to William Styron a while back. You have a picture of Styron and James Jones in the book, and I ask, Styron's books are years and years go by between books.
Yeah.
And I ask him, I said, how do you finance yourself in between these books? He said, well, it helps to have married a wealthy woman.
But Bill has been very successful, too. His books have sold to the movies.
That's right. Sophie's Choice, maybe his masterpiece.
Sophie's Choice, I think, set this house on fire. It was sold, never made. He wrote a very, very good book, a short novel called The Long March.
It's just called Long March.
It's called Long March.
Initially published in a paperback magazine called
That's right.
Discovery. Discovery. It was
Was it sold to the movies? I think
no,
it was.
I don't
no?
believe so. No, mm-hmm. I could be wrong about that, yeah. But I don't recall it ever being made into a film. After its appearance in the magazine, it was published as a paperback, a small paperback, and years later it was published in hardcover.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful
novel.
I know
my Styron.
It's a wonderful novel, novella, if you want. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's one of his better ones, actually.
He's been working for years on a novel about his days in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And but he's had some psychological problems, and that's...
Was he a combat officer in Korea?
He was an officer. He was recalled. He was in the tail end of World War II, but when Korea broke out, he was recalled into service. Reluctantly, he went.
They tried to get me back, too.
Well, let's go on. We'll talk more about Hemingway, but John Ford, tell me about your
John Huston.
John Huston, of course. Your initial contact with John Huston.
John Huston came to my mother's house for dinner. He was not a director as yet. He was a young writer. And he, too, like Hemingway, liked to appear as a father figure. And engaged my brothers and myself in dialogue more than the rather eminent group of guests. And I put it in the book, this one incident where he got me to spar with him in the barn because he'd supposedly been a professional prize fighter. He was very engaging. He was a snake charmer. He loved to charm people, and it didn't matter what age they were. And that was our first meeting, and then I really only met him several years later.
Well, the relationship was solidified, and also with Hemingway, when you and Huston went to...
Yes, well, I'd met John Huston long before Hemingway.
That's right.
But
you had planned to... But the plans were to film a movie with John Garfield.
And Jennifer Jones, yeah. Well, it was a Cuban story, and I was hired by Huston and Sam Spiegel to work on the screenplay. And we decided to go to Havana. I think John partly was dying to meet Hemingway, and it was a good excuse to get out of town. John loved adventure. He loved foreign places, and to go to Cuba instead of sitting in Beverly Hills or Burbank delighted him.
Essentially, you after this period, you became an expatriate, didn't you? Tell me about that.
What happened was rather strange. Right after the war, I was in the Marine Corps during the war, and I'd been in the Pacific, and then I was sent to Europe. But right after the war, I got an assignment to work in Switzerland on a movie for a Swiss company, which Fred Zinnemann sponsored my writing the screenplay. And the strange thing was that once I started on that foreign bent, I got one job after another, all of them in Europe. I went to Africa to work on rewrite the script of The African Queen. I went to Germany with Anatole Litvak to work on a picture called Decision Before Dawn, which was a very good picture, one of the first overseas productions that the 20th Century Fox backed. And from then on, it really led to being an expatriate, you know, that my jobs were all there, and we began to live there. We'd sold the house we built in California after the war. And the hope was to live abroad and to be able to write novels instead of living in California and being a screenwriter.
What's it like taking a chance in the way you have done and other writers have done in writing novels, writing screenplays on a play-by-play or a book-by-book basis? Most of us, I come to work every day and I get a paycheck every Thursday.
Well, that's very true. And looking back now, I'm amazed at my own audacity. Didn't have any money. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I think I had about $700 was my entire fortune. Had to borrow money to build a small house. How I just decided with my first wife to leave all of that and take a chance and live in Europe and hope that everything is going to turn all right, I'm amazed at my own audacity or foolishness.
You mentioned your wife. Now, Hemingway had kind of an interest in Gigi.
Papa was very susceptible to the charms of young women. He was not at all a womanizer. He was very shy, which it seems odd. And she was an adorable, very, very pretty, and very intelligent and well-read. So he got a very serious crush on her. But obviously, he was, she was my wife in the first place. And secondly, he was considerably older than she was. Also, he was under the very sharp eye of his own wife.
Well, in reading Dangerous Friends, it looks to me as though almost everybody had crushes on everybody else.
Well, Gigi certainly was a woman who attracted men, attracted intellectuals. In our business, we're constantly being confronted, if you like, by attractive people, attractive women. And I think probably the temptations are greater than if you're working in a newspaper or any normal kind of pursuit.
No, don't count on that. The degree of marital infidelity was astronomical, as you describe it in the book. Have you ever had any regrets about this?
Oh, sure. I've had not regrets. You censor yourself. I think marital infidelity is pretty commonplace in every walk of life. I mean, we're supposed to be love, honor, and obey till death do us part. I think very few of us stick to that particular oath.
Well, you managed to do it with Ava Gardner. You write about filming the movie in Mexico and sleeping next to Ava Gardner and nothing happened. And that would seem to me it would take an enormous amount of restraint for any man.
Well, I think that any man who is civilized is not going to force his attentions on someone who is not equally enthusiastic about receiving them. And Ava was, as I wrote in my book, Ava was a woman very torn by her own desires and her upbringing and her background, which are rather strict, lower middle class. She was a drinker. She drank quite heavily. That, of course, is not a great aphrodisiac. I think if the lady of your choice or the lady that you're interested in hits the bottle fairly heavily, it's a turnoff.
Now, you mentioned filming the African Queen and doing the script for that. That was really a fateful episode because that led to your book, which, of course, the one was filmed, but that was filmed by Clint Eastwood. Tell me about that, how that came about. It was unusual that you actually used real names.
I didn't use the actual names of people, but I masked the names. I called the hero John Wilson instead of John Huston, which is too close. We went to Africa, and it turned into an incredible adventure. It turned into a sort of a really strange escapade. And when I came back to Switzerland after it was all over, I was stuck on a novel, which often happens, and someone suggested to me, or it occurred to me, that our African trip would make a novel in itself. And I started to write it, really, to get away from the one I was stuck on. And it fell so easily into place. The words just raced through my head. And I think finally it was kind of a letter to a friend, things you can't say to somebody that you can write and mask, a message of disillusionment in him. And still, I always felt a great affection for John, despite the fact that I disapproved of many of the things that I consider to be his faults.
Well, you had some trepidation when you brought the manuscript to John Huston, but it worked out all right, I guess. But he did have some reservations, and you were afraid that he was going to be angry to it.
Yeah, I thought that. Well, I said to him, if you don't want me to publish this, I won't. But Huston was a very sophisticated, very clever man, and he was flattered, I think, to be the protagonist of a serious novel. And as he said to me, he said, nothing anybody writes about me is really going to bother me. I think with time he had second thoughts. He never mentioned it to me again after our initial meetings, in which he suggested a much more violent end than I had conceived. He never mentioned it in his own memoirs, except to friends occasionally. We share a business manager. He said, this man Jess Morgan in California, he said, you ought to read this book if you never read it. It's a hell of a good novel. So I think he realized that it was a critique, but a justified one.
Well, you had another trait that you could share, I guess, with John Huston in Ireland, of course. You guys went to the hounds and the horns. That takes up a big section of the book.
We went to the dogs. Yeah, John he liked to live a life that wasn't the life of a movie director. In Ireland, he was a country gentleman, and Ireland is, I think, the most seductive country in the world, with the possible exception of Scotland. The people are amusing. The talk is rich and great. The thrill of the chase is there, if you like horses and if you like to ride. And he was seduced first, but I really followed quickly in his footsteps. It was a marvelous period of my life that I never regret.
That's a very interesting section, especially the references to Ray Bradbury. I just interviewed Ray Bradbury because, coincidentally, and I don't know if you've read it, he's just published a book called Green Shadows, White Whales.
Yes, I've heard. I've heard.
And it's about John Huston, mm-hmm. and about this period mm-hmm. In Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of it is fictionalized mm-hmm. version mm-hmm. of what happened there during the writing of the screenplay Moby Dick. But
how long ago did the novel come out?
It just came out 2 months ago.
Uh-huh.
2 months. It's brand new. You could
mm-hmm. pick it up.
Get it up at any
yeah.
store. It's beautiful. Well, Bradbury's a beautiful writer,
mm-hmm.
and it's beautifully written. But some of it is fanciful.
Mm-hmm.
It's nonfiction in a way,
yeah.
in a way that Bradbury would write nonfiction.
Yeah.
Bradbury, by the way, does a wonderful imitation of John Huston. Wonderful. I wish I could
do it,
but he has the voice and the accents down just right. But actually, you write, and he doesn't bring this up in his book, but you write that Bradbury and Huston actually had a lot of tension.
No, yeah, they almost came to blows. They had one very, very serious falling out. Ray Bradbury really wasn't the perfect partner for Huston as far as the social aspect of writing a screenplay goes. He did a very good job on Moby Dick, which is a difficult screenplay to write. The film didn't turn out as well, but John admired his work, but as men they didn't get along. And that finally erupted into a very unpleasant scene.
Now, bullfighting, that's a major section of your book, and you became friends with a number of major bullfighters. How did this interest develop?
That really developed partly, I suppose, through my friendship with Hemingway. And just, again, the accidents in one's life propel you forward. I happened to meet Luis Miguel Dominguín on a trip to Spain that Leland Hayward arranged while I was working on The Old Man and the Sea. And he became an immediate friend of one of those inexplicable happenings that you meet somebody, another man who becomes your friend and offered to show me Spain. Well, nobody ever had a better guide to Spain than Dominguín, who was the most famous bullfighter in the world at the time. And with a lot of trepidations and with a lot of reservations, I followed him around. I'm very much against cruelty to animals, and the bullfight is certainly a very cruel spectacle. But if you become friends of a bullfighter, it really removes your objectivity, because you want him to survive more than anything else.
You had so many parties and dinners and trips and travels. You wonder how you found time to write.
Well, I'd probably have written more if I hadn't had all those. You know, you have to have a certain discipline to write. And as you say, or as you suggest, it's much, much easier if you stay in the same place. Like Tolstoy sat in his ranch and his farm and wrote these enormous novels. I think later on in his life, and not that I'm comparing myself to Tolstoy, but I mean it's an object lesson in that if you stay in one place, you're able to produce much more as a writer. At the same time, for a certain kind of writer, such as Isherwood, such as Hemingway, to move out of your background to see the rest of the world and write about the world is a big help. The difficult part is sitting down after you have an idea and sticking with it. Then one of the other things that made me move around is that I had to make a living. My mother had stopped being as successful a screenwriter as she'd been. She never saved her money, so I had family obligations there and to my wife, and who became my ex-wife. So I had to go where the action was. I had to go where I could get a job.
Well, you mentioned your ex-wife. You're very candid about what happened with regard to leaving your wife at the time. And there was a certain animosity among your circle of friends. Can you tell me about that?
Well, less animosity than disapproval. I think that if you're unfortunate, perhaps, enough to start on writing your reminiscences, you're going to have to write about certain parts of certain actions that you took in life or that they're less than complimentary and that make you suffer when you look back and see the things that you did that are that you disapprove of and that you fell into and that you wish you hadn't done, you know. But I think when you start to write your reminiscences, it better be fairly honest, or as honest as you can make it. Otherwise, it's just patting yourself on the back. And that aspect of my life, that incident in my life, was, I think, the worst thing I've ever done, in that I left her when she was about to have a child. Had fallen in love with another woman. But there you are. It was certainly common gossip. It would be a strange book of reminiscences if I hadn't included it.
The 1950s was a political time, too, and a difficult time for people who were on the left wing. And you yourself were suspect by the certain elements within the government for your politics. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, my mother was a big supporter of left-wing causes in that she was a member of the Anti-Nazi League. Don't forget, in that time, the Communist Party to a lesser degree, the Socialists were really the only opponents of Nazism, the world fascism. And my mother was what was known as a premature fascist. She was never a member of the Communist Party. She never had any real sympathy for the Communist Party because she believed in God. She had a sense of religion. She thought, as many intellectuals of the time did, that socialism was a solution for the world. My first wife, Jaiji, had actually been a member of the Young Communist League, or whatever it was called in Hollywood. All these people were brought to the Communist Party or the adjuncts of the Communist Party by their desire to fight fascism, by their desire to oppose Hitlerism, which was the greatest menace that the world had ever known, in that in a modern world, he threatened to take over all of Europe, possibly even the United States. So that the fact that these people were drawn to another social system which used them was rather because the Communist Party was really directed from Moscow, and the Russians were out to protect their own foreign policy and used the people who were enthusiastic followers of the party line for their own benefit. I was always very opposed to them.
To
the Communist Party line, because when I was 15 or 16 years old, or 17, it was just about the time of the pact between the Germans and the Russians. Nor was I ever very interested in politics at that time. I loved to play tennis and was interested in writing. But I was actually violently opposed, as was Erwin Shaw and the people that were my close friends, to the Communist Party line and to their functions in California. Although the people who were members of to some degree of the party or who were sympathizers really never exploited their positions, never really used their influence in their work. I mean, the movies of the 50s were certainly devoid of political propaganda. I mean, I can't remember one movie that you really feel was a communist influence. And the Dies Committee and the whole hearings that came up were a terrible time for the town, and very unjust for a great many people who had, all right, they had political sympathies. The party was certainly not an illegal organization, but they were menaced by it. Their livelihood was menaced.
Well, you were in the reserve, weren't you? After you,
I was in the Marine. Well, I joined the Marine Corps, and of course the reserve as enlisted man. And then it was sent to Quantico. Ultimately, it was sent to Quantico, Virginia, and became a reserve officer in the Marine Corps. And was actually about to be recalled for duty in Korea, which, thank God, the fact that I was in Europe kept me from having to go there. But as a reserve officer, there were all kinds of questions were asked later on as well. And as I put in my book,
they called you in.
I had to face this.
Worried about your mother's politics?
Yeah,
really. I mean, what does? How can they get away? They didn't get away with it, actually, did they?
Well, you know, the Marine Corps is a, t- to my mind, there are a lot of things wrong with it as an organization, but it's a very, there are very many admirable people in the Marine Corps. And I'm not a fan of the militaries, but I must say that although this naval directive came out saying all reserve officers, their political alliances and affiliations should be reinvestigated. So I was one of the people who was called. Curiously enough, it came about because of a review in the Hollywood Reporter of a picture I'd written with John Huston, which was called We Were Strangers. And that Billy Wilkinson and the paper called it a blatant communist propaganda that John Garfield and John Huston and I were communists. And some idiot picked it up in naval intelligence. And there I was having to face not a court-martial, but an investigation, an investigative hearing, which is very unpleasant. But the, as I put in my book, the lieutenant colonel in charge was a very civilized and charming man. And he saw at once, you know, I said I'd never been a member of the party. I'd never had any communist sympathies. How could I be questioned on my mother's politics or my ex-wife's? And so he said to the investigating lieutenant, he said, you know, desist from this line of questioning. And later on he said to me, Lieutenant Vertel, you don't have anything to worry about.
Yeah, and reading your memoir, it doesn't seem to me that you really had very much concern about politics one way or the other.
No, I didn't. Well, you know, obviously during the period, the advent of Hitlerism, we were all concerned, not only because of being a Jew, or not only, but it really seemed like the most retrograde movement in the history of the world, German fascism, and to a lesser degree, Italian fascism as well. But after that, after, you know, my gunnery sergeant used to say, when somebody said, I've done my share, he said, what do you think, your share is around like an orange that you get it all over with in one jump? But that's once you've been in a war, and once you spend 4 years in the service of your country, you kind of feel, well, the hell with it. Now I just wanted to live and make a little money and enjoy life.
Now, at one point, you met Deborah Carr. Tell me about that. Well, what happened as a result of that meeting?
Working for Litvak, again, late in the game, at the end of the 50s, he asked me to come and help correct or add to a film that he was about to make, and Deborah was the star. And as I think I've put in my book, millions of men the world over had fallen in love with her just seeing her on the screen. Meeting her had even a greater impact and a more equally understandable one. It certainly did on me. And I was fortunate enough that we liked each other, to put it in a low key. And we made our, for one reason or another, through a series of incidents that I don't particularly want to go into, we decided to make our life together, our lives.
And that you have done.
And that we have done.
So you have, you kind of summarize it toward the end of the book, but tell me about how you are living your life now and where you live.
We have, for years and years, for I guess it's about since 1958, we've had a house in Switzerland where our kids grew up. I had one child from my first marriage. My wife died when the little girl, when Christine, my daughter, was 6 years old. And Deborah had two children from her first marriage. And they all grew up there in a very bucolic and beautiful setting. And ultimately, as you get older, the cold doesn't appeal to you as much. So we bought a tiny little farmhouse in the south of Spain, and we spent our time between these two places.
Sounds pretty glamorous.
Well, I don't know about glamorous. You know,
well, living in the nitty-gritty of the west side of New York, it sounds glamorous.
Well, you know, living in Spain is much more difficult than living in the United States. Everything is a problem, whether it's the electricity or the plumbing or whatever it is. The roads are far less safe than the United States. People drive like maniacs. Crime, I suppose, is a little less violent than it is in the United States. It's agreeable, but glamorous, I'm not so sure.
Well, I kind of wrap things up. Hemingway, you were notified on the telephone that Hemingway had been in a hunting accident. Tell me about this.
Well, this was, I hadn't seen him for a year and a half, and I was in Biarritz and the ferry of Pamplona was about to begin, and I was going to go again as I had gone for many years, when Art Buchwald called me from Paris, and Art at the time was a stringer for Variety, and he was already beginning to become a famous columnist. But he called me, and he said, "Peter, there's been this report's just come through on the wireless that or on the telex that Papa Hemingway has shot himself." And I said, "Well, that's just impossible." Knowing how careful he was with guns, that seemed just incredible. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was, you know, a canard. And then, as it turned out, he killed himself. And I'd known already from friends like Bill Walton and Slim Hayward, I'd known that he was in very poor health, that he'd been subjected to shock treatments at the Mayo Clinic. And I think he became more self-destructive than he had ever been. And he realized that he couldn't write anymore. He realized he couldn't read anymore. He could barely take a walk around his house. And he just felt enough's enough.
John Huston, on the other hand, of course, you don't report on his death because he, as an indomitable figure, he lumbered on for years and years. And even up to his death, he was working on a movie. He had emphysema. I saw photographs of his machine, and he was still working.
Yeah, he was amazing, John, and a tremendous courage. I went to see him about a year before he died, and he had all these tubes in his nose and everything. And we talked for half an hour, and he said, "I'm sorry, Pete, this is as much as I can do right now. I got to rest." Well, heartbreaking to see. He still tried to direct a movie after that. Orson was a great friend and a supporter and whatnot, whatever you like. I mean, almost one of the people in my life who I was always glad to see.
Oh, tell me, you have a wonderful description of Orson and his gigantic
robe. Orson was a tragic to see, more tragic than John, because Huston, went on functioning. I think someone asked John, "What's the most important thing in your life, love or health, or what is it?" And John said, "An interest." And that kept him going, even when he was absolutely bedeviled by emphysema. Orson had an interest, but Orson was not permitted really to function, because as a director, people distrusted him, wrongly, I think. So his last years were spent writing screenplays that were never made. And it was rather tragic. He did voiceovers. And he never complained. He was tremendously gallant and laughed at himself, although I think he was more than upset at his own fate. And he was enormously fat at the end. And it was really, really sad to see him in his last few days.
Now, Irwin Shaw, who you describe as possibly your best friend, you say he could really be the subject of another book, couldn't he?
Yes, well, Irwin was my best friend. He was my closest friend for many, many, I don't know, 40 years. And Irwin was somewhat self-destructive, too, in that he drank a great deal.
Toward the end of his life.
Toward the end of his. But he was that tremendous output. He wrote, I mean, he's written hundreds and hundreds of marvelous short stories. He's written many novels, some good, some not so good. But he was a real liver, Irwin. He lived it up to the nth degree. And his literary output was quite amazing. And he was, I think of all the people I've known in my life, he was the greatest, what shall I say, he was the greatest, I don't know, he made people happy by his enthusiasm for life and by his generosity. More than anyone, more than Orson, more than Papa, more than anyone, he really socially had a circle around him that adored him and that enjoyed the town, the life that he led, and we'll never forget him for that reason.
Did you read a fairly recent biography?
Yes, I did.
Someone named Schneerson.
Schneerson, yes. It's quite good. It has many things in it that are very good. He was unkind to Irwin's wife, only, I think, because he never had a chance to meet her. But Irwin's life would make a marvelous biography on its own. It would be difficult for me to write. You know, I'm not a really a nonfiction writer. I like to write novels and make things up. But I think someone will come along and write about Irwin. Maybe I'll write one day sort of short sketches of the people that I left out this time.
The 1950s, that was really a good decade for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, I think, a good decade for all of us, for Hollywood, too. They say it's the golden years. I'm not so sure that it was altogether the golden years, but certainly the 40s, the 50s, and to a degree the 60s, they were very good times for all of us. Of course, then Vietnam came along, which cast a pall on the United States, I think.
I just wonder, though, I have this theory that our memories are selective, and we somehow sift through the bad things and keep the good ones in our memories. As I look back, I was a high school kid in the 50s. They look pretty good to me now, but at the time, I don't think they look so good because I went through the adolescent adjustment problems that most kids have and the torturous the problems that you have with other people. And now they look pretty good, but at the time, I'm not sure they were.
Yeah, of course you only remember the good times. Thank God one remembers only the good times or intends to remember the good times more than the bad times. But I think the 50s, don't forget, the war was over. Hitler had been defeated. The world had been liberated, really, from this monstrosity of fascism. You couldn't help but feel that the better days lay ahead. And you couldn't help but enjoy yourself. Don't forget, we went to Europe freely for the first time. That was an adventure. You could go to the China if you wanted to, anywhere.
Yeah, someone was telling me the other day that the 50s, there was a feeling of optimism in the 50s.
I think so. I think after World War II, there was a general optimism in the world that hasn't really returned.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the Gulf War, there was a moment of feeling, well, we'd reestablish ourselves as a country, but there this guy, Saddam Hussein, was still in power, so you couldn't really have a feeling of euphoria after that.
So when can we expect a new novel from you, or can we give you a rest for a while?
No, I'm getting to the age where I better make the most of what time I have left. And I hope to be able to finish a novel in a year. I have one that's already started, and it's just a question of whether you're lucky enough to be able to finish it.
Well, Dangerous Friends, I felt kind of like a voyeur in a way as I was reading the book, because you had so many intimate glimpses of people. Absolutely fascinating. It's beautifully written, the memoir by Peter Vertil. Beautiful, Dangerous Friends. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.